Okay, I've got it on, and it is the 15th of February, 2014. We're at Narcisse, and we're going to have a Bible study. So let's look to the Lord, prepare ourselves in prayer, and see where we go. Lord, we come before you. We open your word. We ask you to be in our midst, to guide us, to grow within us, to mold us into your image. We pray this in Jesus' name and say, Amen. Interesting. I prayed that to be molded into his image, and yet we're in the image of God. And that's something that is crucial for people to remember. Anybody you see on the planet, they're all bearing the image of God. It's very important. No matter how much a person corrupts that image, and it can be pretty despicable, but we still bear the image of God, and those who want to be closer to God have to always remember that, and that will come up in our Bible study today. So, what did I want to share on? I wanted to go back to the Shema and start looking at some very basic issues. Go through the Shema, make sure people know it. We repeat it every Shabbat here, and there's a reason why we repeat it. When Jesus was asked the question, what must I do to inherit eternal life? He threw the question back and he says, well, how do you read? And the guy said, he started quoting the Shema. And then he added Leviticus 19 to it. And Jesus said, yes, very good answer. So this has been part of the reason why we recite the Shema, because it's part of our gospel tradition. And also those that study history know that in antiquity, the Shema was recited in the morning and in the evening. And it was linked to receiving the kingdom of heaven. The rabbis said, when we recite the Shema, we are receiving the kingdom of heaven. What does that mean? It means to draw close to God, to acknowledge God as your Father, as your King, to let Him rule you. In effect, to love Him, and that's what we're going to see, because as we turn to the Shema, we're going to see that the central word here is love. And a month ago or so, we gave a Bible study here, and we discussed the centrality of love and how the opposite of that can fragment society and prevent a lot of things from building and becoming good. We have to have a basis of love if we're going to have goodness. Okay, Shema. Deuteronomy 6:4 starts off, Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. And some of you, I think, are familiar that in the traditional transcribing, writing out of the text, that the first and last letter of that in Hebrew are big, and they spell it Shema. Well, it's the last letter of the first word, Shema, with a big ayin, and then Ahad with a big dalet, and they spell the word Ed, which means witness. So this is a testimony. And if you know the history of the word testimony, it actually gets to where our word in English today, martyr, comes from testimony, because to give a testimony, if you were hauled before a Roman circus and asked to recant, if you give a testimony, you could end up paying for it with your life. And that's where this word martyr developed out of testimony. And within Jewish tradition, people would say the Shema. There were people, you will see sometimes in a Holocaust movie when they're led into the gas chambers and you'll hear somebody start to call out Shema Israel. And this is the testimony before an ultimate trial, a trial of death, and you give a testimony. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Okay, that's a little bit of the background. It's not part of the meaning of the text as it was given, but it's part of the history of the text, how it's been used. Now, Shema Israel Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Ahad. As simple as that first sentence is, we're not exactly sure how it hangs together. We know who it's talking about. We know that God is calling us to Himself, establishing a covenant, calling us to be faithful. But we don't know how these words hang together. So let me... Well, we could try it with English. Could you read that translation? John, could you read the translation you have?
Sure. What's our verse exactly?
Please. 6:4.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone.
Okay. The Lord is our God, the Lord alone. That's two sentences. That's good. Does anybody have it in one sentence? Yes.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one.
The Lord our God, comma, the Lord is one. Okay, good. There are other translations. The strangest one that I ever heard came at the end of... Somebody wrote a whole book about sentences like this. These are sentences in Hebrew that don't have a verb in them. And he wrote a whole book on them. And you would think somebody that would write a whole book would get it right. And in fact, it's one of these things where people, when they play with a language and it's artificial for them and they don't use it, they can end up painting themselves into a corner. So this person came up with a translation that... Let me try to remember it, because it's really... okay, I think it was, our one God is the Lord, the Lord. Now that's different. It's still, of course, the basic same point. But I like the translation that I heard where it was one sentence. The Lord our God, comma, the Lord is one. Making one sentence out of it, you get something that is sort of like a dangling introduction. The Lord our God, and then you don't say it. You just stop there, pause, and then you say, the Lord is one. And as you heard, another way to say it, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Also, very... proper, possible translation into English, and it just all depends on how you break it up. Anyway,
the Lord alone, or the only one. That's
well,
the Lord is one. It's the Lord alone, the
okay.
only one.
The Lord alone, the only
That's
one.
True.
Well, there. They're playing with the word one there.
Yeah.
And all communication, remember that the meaning of a communication is not just what is said, but it's what is said against what is assumed. That happens always in all communication. Everything you ever say is always interpreted against assumptions. And so if you think that Moses is writing against certain assumptions, that will affect how you interpret this word one. Does he assume there are other gods? Then this word, the Lord is the one, then you might think of him as, you know, the Lord alone is our God, the Lord is perhaps the only God, if you think he's a different set of assumptions on what is out there. If you think of the other gods as being nothing, then the Lord is one means the Lord is the only God. If you think that there are real other gods out there, then the Lord becomes the one God, and the others are irrelevant. In any case, let's think of, I'm trying to illustrate what I said earlier. If a parent has a little child and says, you know, the child is out playing in the yard, and the parent says, you know, you can't play close to the street. You have to come in. You can't play on the other side of the sidewalk, let's say. And then the next day, the child is playing there again. And the parent may say, well, go ahead. See if I care. Go ahead and play there. See if I care. Now, is the parent expressing that they don't care? Or is the parent expressing that they are extremely frustrated with the child? And the child is on the border of getting punished. What? Yeah, maybe both. So anyway, the point is that communication is not just what you say, but it's based on the assumptions that the speaker and the audience are sharing. And the speaker and the audience are always guessing, and that's why there are questions of clarification. What did you mean? Well, you know what I meant. Well, no, what did you really mean? And so, in that sense, communication is negotiated, or meaning is negotiated between a speaker and an audience, because we don't have time to say everything that is being assumed. And as soon as we try, we leave something out. Anyway, enough on that. But I'm trying to explain how this word one can end up being translated so many different ways, because it is affected by the assumptions that the people are assuming in the background against which this communication comes. Okay,
but one on the other side, the Arabic side, the word Allah means their God, and the Arabic word for God. And how, if they would have to say that, you know, Allah is one, that would be a problem for them. Elohim.
Yes.
How does this, you know, the saying, Engel Belabdo?
Yeah.
You see it on color.
Sure, sure, sure.
How does this relate to this? Or is there a relationship? Or?
It's related. I mean,
it's basically saying the same thing. Because from what I understand, it means to only worship the one or something.
Sure.
But is it like intended towards Christianity? Because Christians think that
I don't know.
God, you know?
I don't know. Yeah.
They're saying we only hold to clean. Have to worship the one.
Yeah, I don't know. In some cases today it might be that. I know that, for instance, there's another similar saying, Mi Moshe le Moshe ein kmo Moshe, if you've heard that. And that's referring to Moses, the giver of Torah, and Moses Maimonides in the Middle Ages. And so to say between Moses and Moses, there's no one besides Moses, what they're doing is it's a roundabout way of denying that Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecy to be the second Moses. In Deuteronomy, if you remember, it says he will raise up a prophet. And so in Peter's speech, we have these references right at the beginning of the book of Acts to Moses, to Jesus being that prophet. And so Christians claim that Jesus is the prophet prophesied in Deuteronomy. And then if somebody comes and says, Mi Moshe le Moshe ain't k'mo Moshe.
Yeah, because Jesus was in the middle.
Because Jesus is in the middle, if you know that the first one refers to Moses' Torah of the Bible, and the second one is Maimonides in Egypt, and the time period, then, and you know about this prophecy, then you understand that this is actually a very subtle way of denying that Jesus is the Messiah or the second Moses.
I don't know if it's so subtle.
What?
I don't know if it's so subtle.
Okay, it's not so subtle.
It's very blunt.
It's very blunt. But why is it subtle? Because people that don't know the background wouldn't have a clue. You could say, from Moses to Moses, there's none like Moses, and 99% of the world would have no idea that that was a denial that Jesus is the Messiah. So in that sense, it's very subtle. If you know the background, it's as subtle as a sledgehammer. If you don't know the background, no communication whatsoever. That's where you have to say, what does that mean? Okay, we're getting way off track, but maybe that was a good diversion just for us to be aware of how meaning is communicated. All right, let's go on. Ve'ahavta at Adonai Elohecha b'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol me'odecha. I'm going to say a couple of not very meaningful things at the beginning, and then we're going to get into something more meaty. Ve'ahavta. Listen to how it is said. Ve'ahavta. A lot of times you will hear people today that speak Hebrew say, ve'ahavta. And since we recite the Shema in Hebrew here, I would encourage you all to say it according to this language, which is ve'ahavta. The Shema and the word ve'ahavta in biblical Hebrew is ve'ahavta, with the accent on the ta. And that means you will love. And you will love. You will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your ma'od. And if you look at that, your heart, well, that's a noun, with all your heart. And with all your soul, personhood, that's a noun. And ma'od in this verse looks like it's a noun. But it's not used like a noun anyplace else in the Hebrew Bible. Just here. And so if normally it's a, today we say tov me'od, very good. It's good and it's me'od good. And me'od is what we call in English, we call that an adverb. It's modifying an adjective or a verb or something. And so we, me'od has become in Hebrew an adverb, but here it's a noun. And so if you wanted to translate with all your veriness, you know, with all your oomph, and it's unique into this passage. Okay, those are on the side. But I want to go into some substance. What does it mean, ve'ahavta, and you will love the Lord your God? This is central. This is right at the kernel of our existence, of our relationship to God, that we will love God. And, you know, just how far does that go, and what does it mean? Let me add some background now, and then it will take on some new meaning. Is it love if there's a sword hanging over your head? Is that loving God? And in what sense could we say that people have a sword over their head? Well, for instance, we're on this earth and we're told we're all going to die. That the punishment of sin is death, and that the whole human race is suffering the punishment of death. So in one sense, we are being called to love God. And we also know that in the creation that He's put us, we're under a death penalty. So is that love? There are other things that we can think of in terms of love. Now, it's an adult Bible study here. Yeah, okay. Husbands and wives love each other. But there is something that pulls them together, that sometimes we think of as less than love, and that's sex. Husbands love their wives, wives love their husbands, but they also have something that keeps them together. Now, does that diminish love, the fact that there is an incentive, that there's something pulling them together? It's a question. I'm just throwing these out to get us thinking about what this means to love God. You shall love the Lord your God. So let's get away from husband and wife, since that word love can have a very physical side to it. Let's go to children and parents. That's easier. Children love their parents. They're loyal to their parents. And we don't have to worry about the murkiness of the physical usage of the word love with children and parents. But there's still some kind of a, it isn't a pure metaphysical love. The child still is getting benefit from the parents. The child is provided for. The child gets hugs and warm fuzzies. It gets put to bed at night with a kiss. Hopefully, anyway. And the child is fed. They get up in the morning and the child gets all the food they want. If they don't think they've gotten enough, they cry. They get more. And the child loves the mother and the father. And they're getting benefits. So they're loving. But it isn't 100% pure selfless love. There is a benefit. If we throw it the other way around, we might find it a little more selfless. The parent loving the child. So the parent loves the child, provides for the child, takes care of the child. That love is a little bit more selfless. But if you wanted to be cynical and say, even the parent is getting benefit, and the parent is also getting benefit because the parent is building a legacy. You know, the legacy of having your children carry on your, whatever it is, your identity, your empire, your, there's something about you that the children are carrying on. So the parent has an investment in these children. So they're also getting benefit. What I'm trying to do is show that in all of these cases, even though we like to talk about love abstractly as something that is pure, and it is, right at the heart of the universe is God, and God is love. But just like you can't escape gravity and you can't escape energy and light inside the creation, love is somehow reciprocal and it comes around and takes care of you. So there's something wonderful about love, and you do get benefit from love. Now, I shared that so we can ask, how far does this love go? And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And what does that mean for our lives? And how does that affect us? In the Western world, we often think in terms of religion being separate from the daily world. A person goes off into their closet, off into their church building, their synagogue, their mosque, their temple, whatever. They do religious rites, and then they come back and live in the real world. And in the modern Western world, this is divided. You can go love God by yourself somewhere. Is that a possibility with this verse? Can love be expressed? Can you say that you love God in a religious service and then walk outside of the service and leave that love behind? And everybody's looking at me like, what a silly question when you phrase it like that. And I would agree, that is a silly question. Yes?
I think that's a good question, because that's what we're up against in America right now. Some politicians and groups are trying to say that it's good to do all that kind of stuff behind closed doors, but don't you bring it into politics.
Right. So it is, someone just said, no, that's not a silly question. People are actually trying to do that, even in the United States, where freedom of religion is enshrined in the law, but it's being manipulated in such a way that it's sometimes trying to be marginalized to such an extreme that people maybe aren't able to love God anymore. Yes?
I think that I'm wondering if maybe God hasn't put us in relationships in family to teach us the answer to this question.
Okay.
That all of these different ways that we relate to families, to people, are a way of teaching us this is how, done right, done perfectly, this is how God loves us.
Okay.
In other words, it's a way of teaching us. So
that families, just to make sure this got heard for the recording, that families are a way to guarantee that we will learn about and you shall love the Lord your God. That we learn about love inside a family through its multifaceted relationships and responsibilities and loyalty and comfort.
I think, for example, that in a marriage, it's a crucible of how to love God. Because it can be done, and it's exactly where we're attacked the most, because that's exactly where we there's the most hate. But it can be the place where we can most concretely and most directly see the face of God.
Okay, so
I think, for example, if you have a good marriage and if you are willing to devote to love that person, and that person loves you, then even maybe especially in sex, then you can see the face of God.
Oh, I like the way this is going. Hogla, the Bible study's over.
Words of wisdom are leaving tomorrow.
Okay, all right. Well, anyway, maybe that did, maybe that didn't get recorded. So, but let me, I agree, and. God, who is love, who made the creation, set all of this in order. And it is part of what love is. And I'm going to throw something into the mix here. And I'm going to bring it in from the New Testament, but we're going to immediately see that it's actually part of the Old Testament. In 1 John 4, it says that it asks a question, or makes a statement, can a person say that they love God and hate their brother? And the answer, of course, is no. You cannot say that you love God and hate your brother. And I mentioned that the fact that all human beings bear the image of God is, puts a tremendous call on every individual, a call of loyalty and a call, a challenge of our love of God. If we say we love God, then We are committing ourselves to love all those who bear the image of God.
Because Jesus, he says, if you love your children, you love your wife. In fact, he goes so far as to say, unless you hate them, you're not worthy of me. How does that fit in?
Okay, we might be able to get there this morning, but you know, the question was raised when, you know, Jesus said you have to hate your father and mother, and I think there what he was saying is a it's relational, saying that you have to put God on top.
Yeah, if they lead you away from God, you have to choose God above them.
That I think is what everyone has said this. I'm going to quote somebody I saw about a month ago on a little blurb. Some of you have heard there's a show in the United States called Duck Dynasty. And they were interviewing one of the guys. His name was Jason. There's, you know, like, what is this like being, you know, all of a sudden you're a star. Here you were, a family in Louisiana, and now you're a television star, and everybody knows who you are. And he says, you know, he says that's got, you know, huge challenges. And from the beginning of their television show, they've said, we've had to keep our priorities in line. God, family, ducks. It's in that order. It was funny, but it's also hits that truth. God, family, ducks.
And for those who don't know, they became a big controversy about 2 months ago.
Oh dear, no, we don't want to go there.
They stood for God. It just became a controversy. I didn't know
yeah.
it until it became
okay.
a controversy.
Yeah, well,
and then I saw who they were. You know, so.
Yeah, they've
what's
been.
A duck?
What's a duck? It's
a.
That's right, a duck. This family, they're millionaires. Their family business is selling duck calls to duck hunters, and they love duck hunting. So that's why they said, God, family, ducks. Got to keep your priorities straight. As long as we keep our priorities straight, everything flows. So that, and I think that's the answer to your question. But I'm going to read on the Shema a little bit more. We haven't quite finished. Ve'ahavta. There are four ve'ahavtas in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible. Ve'ahavta. That specific form, ve'ahavta, occurs four times in the Hebrew Bible. And some of you know where they are. Danny? Okay, that's number three. Where was two? Actually, that was number one, if you think in terms of our canonical order.
So that's number one.
Yeah.
Number two.
It's also number two. Right. That was the trick question. It's in Deuteronomy 11, it says, Ve'ahavta again. And it's Deuteronomy 11 that in the longer version of the Shema, in the synagogue, Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9 would be read, and then Deuteronomy 11, I think verse 13 through 21 approximately, would be read. And that links two chapters that have this link of Ve'ahavta, and it 13 says, and when you obey these commandments, and it goes on listing several things, and then it jumps. And the third section of the Shema is from Numbers 15, verse 37 through 41. And that brings in some of the ceremonial memory, you know, to wear tzitziot, to remember your relationship with God. And we'll see it also at the beginning here of Deuteronomy 6, where it talks about totafot beinecha, ot al yedecha, v'totafot beinecha. So this, some kind of a ceremonial connection was, you know, links these three passages that become the longer version of the Shema. And then, already in pre-Christian antiquity, we have what Danny mentioned, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And that was seen as the reflection, the mirror image, the other side to and you shall love the Lord your God. You shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You can't love God and hate your neighbor. If we say we love God, we do not have a right to hate anyone. You know, a lot of people think they have a right to bitterness. You don't. We do not have a right to be bitter. We don't have a right to hate. It's just not on the cards. And that's what God, who is love, who is the creator of the universe, who has set everything in motion, he said, you have to love me with all of your heart. You are not allowed to hate. You can't have pure hate. You can't have pure bitterness.
Sorry, what was the New Testament reference you gave us earlier?
1 John 4.
No, where Jesus answers.
Oh, Jesus answers. That's Luke 10, verses 22 through...
Okay, thank you.
I don't remember. 28 or something. That leads on into the Good Samaritan parable, which gets us to the fourth Ve'ahavta. Danny mentioned, and you shall love your friend or neighbor who is like you. And then a little bit later in Leviticus 19, you get the fourth Ve'ahavta, and you shall love the sojourner, because you were sojourners in Egypt. And Jesus, when he is given the question, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Or as it's recorded in Matthew, Mahu klal gadol b'Torah, what's the big commandment in the law? And the man answers, you shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. He's put those two together. They were already put together. This was in pre-Christian times, those were linked and seen as being inseparably linked, that you can't really have one without the other. You can't really love your neighbor if you don't have love for God. You can't really love God if you don't love your neighbor. These two somehow had to come together. And then Jesus answers, and he goes on later to the end of Leviticus 19, and he tells them a story about the Good Samaritan, which brings in the idea of the foreigner. Because in Hebrew, you shall love your friend. Who is my friend? Who's my neighbor? Just how far does that go? And Jesus, in a sense, gives a parable that illustrates the other, and you shall love. And you shall love the sojourner. So, Jesus' answer of the Good Samaritan, in a sense, removes any limit. And if we want to philosophize and put words into this, then our love of our neighbor is extended to all who bear the image of God. You know, who is our neighbor? Our neighbor is someone who bears the image of God. We don't have the right to ultimately hate that person. We do have a right to defend ourselves. I'm not saying that there are very evil people in the world, and that was part of what I wanted to also talk about. This has taken longer in the preamble part. There are evil things in this world, and we need to fight them, and we do need to defend truth. And that works into love. Loving your neighbor and not having hatred and bitterness does not mean that you extend the right to evil to spread and kill or be evil. So let's go on.
I'm going to Luke 10:27. I ask, because how many times did Jesus answer somebody and say, "That's right, brother"? Not very often.
This is pretty central.
Was important.
This was pretty central. This is pretty central.
Said, "That's right, brother."
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I've heard it preached where it was tongue in cheek that Jesus meant well, it's right if you could do it, but you, since you can't do it, don't try. Or some, you know, some...
The rich young ruler or something.
Yeah. Anyway. But no, this is part of what it means to be a follower of the Messiah. Now, if we go on the Shema here, listen to how it finishes. And these words that I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you will sharpen them on your children, and you will say to them, you will speak them in your lying down at home and in your walking in the road, or in your staying at home, and in your lying down and in your getting up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They will be as a totefet, as a tot for totefot, between your eyes. You will write them on the doorposts of your house and in your on your gates. And what I wanted to open up on this whole idea of love gets to this verse, and you shall sharpen them for your children. Now, I'm purposefully translating that vishinantam very literally. Some people think there's a word in Hebrew, shina, that means to repeat something, and there's a word shinan, lesh, or shinen, to sharpen. And of course, if you sharpen something, if you whittle it down to a point, you keep making the same motion over and over again. So I can take this verb sharpen and make it a metaphor for teaching my children to really get them to where they need to be. And of course, it means there's repetition. So whether you take this Hebrew verb and say it's a biform of the other Hebrew verb that means to repeat, or whether you take it as a metaphor, sharpen, it still means that we are called to train up the next generation in loving God and loving their neighbor. Yes?
I have a question about why don't Christians do what it says, like the Jews do. They put it on the forehead, they put it on, and they put it on the door, on the gates, and still do. Mm. So why don't Christians do that?
Well, Christians don't do it literally because it wasn't literally mentioned in the New Testament, and they also were specified. It was, they had this long debate about whether the Gentiles have to become Jews or not. So we won't go there this morning. I'd like to come back because this week is the 25th anniversary of something that illustrates a problem that we have, I think, in the West with, and you shall sharpen them, you shall train them in these words. And 25 years ago, there was someone who had written a book, and his name was Salman Rushdie, and a religious leader got up and put a death sentence on him and said, all of my followers have the right to kill this man on sight. That was the famous fatwa against Salman Rushdie. That was 25 years ago. I think it was this week. I may be off. But since that, over the last 25 years, what we have seen in the West is a retreat from being able to say that something is true and false, that something is evil. That is evil. You can't clothe that and say, oh, well, that's their religion. You know, their religion is to burn tires and kill people. That's not an acceptable excuse. And what has happened in the West is what some have called a kind of creeping thimitude, where we have self-retreated. We don't want to offend anybody. And so we we let them dictate what is right and wrong, and we tell our own children, ultimately there is no right and wrong, so it doesn't really matter. It's certainly not worth getting in a tiff about, so we'll just slowly back ourselves off into a corner. And that is not truth. Truth and love also demands that we are able to say that is evil. And the system that would produce that is evil. You know, there is something at the core, I would call it a religious totalitarianism. Religious totalitarianism is evil. And if at the core of Islam you have religious totalitarianism, then it is perfectly good. In fact, it needs to be said that is evil. Now, glass houses, etc., you don't throw stones. The Inquisition, that's okay in the West to say the Inquisition was evil. Religious totalitarianism is evil. And we need to be able to train our children in such a way that we can say that is evil.
Isn't that what the Constitution is based on? You're not allowed to impose your religion on others.
Yes.
But you are allowed to bring your religious beliefs into the assembly with you, into the Congress.
You are allowed to live your life. You're not allowed to impose your religion on someone else. You cannot force someone to become your religion. It also means you're going to have something of a thick skin, because when people do things you don't like, you're going to have to agree to live with them. And this is part of the legal system that's come into...
The thing that you were talking about before is the tolerance thing.
The intolerant, totalitarian.
No, tolerance. Before you were talking about there's no such thing as evil and good. And it's the thing of tolerance that you tolerate, and the only evil is that you say something is wrong or right.
Yes, what we would call an over-tolerance may itself turn out to be evil.
Mm-hmm. But now what you're saying is that we... Nobody has a right to impose their beliefs on somebody.
That's true. That is true. That is what we accept. And this is something that is at the heart of a problem that is in the West. Now, I read an article this week, an op-ed, and the person was talking about the Rushdie fatwa, and he said the fault of the Rushdie fatwa does not lie with Islam, it lies with the West for not calling it evil. He didn't add for not calling it evil. He just said, the biggest problem with this whole thing is not really Islam, it's the West. The problem is the West being afraid to call evil evil. That's the problem.
Yeah, but how can you say the West? There are plenty of people. What are you saying in general?
There are plenty of people. I'm calling it evil, and I'm in the West. And guess what? I'm not allowed. If I were to say what I just said in public in the United States, and I had a big following, I would have hordes of newspaper articles ranting against me. People that have made statements like that in high government offices have been run out of office or lost their positions in the military, people up in the Department of Defense.
Who's behind that?
Well, I don't know. I would call it evil, though. Whatever it is, it isn't one person. What it is it's a lack of training our children in what is truth and being able to stand up for truth and say this.
There are organizations that promote this, you know.
Yes.
I mean, somebody has to be doing this.
It's not just, no, it's not, it's a mindset, it's a culture. There's a culture that...
I think that when I was young, there wasn't mosques in the United States. There weren't any mosques in the United States that anybody knew of.
They were there.
Well, not very many. I nobody had ever heard of that. And so today, I think it's just a matter of how many there are, the majority of the people. And there's a lot of influence.
Well, anyway,
also very wealthy people.
I don't want this to get too far off. Right. We're not talking about mosques and the right to build a mosque. What we're talking about is whether a person can call something that is evil, evil. And religious totalitarianism is evil. It means what you see in Saudi Arabia is actually evil. You know, those people do not have the right to leave Islam. And
do you think there's any degree of that in Israel? As far as
you use? You can say that there's a degree, but there is no death. Well, there are crazy people that in every society there are crazy people that will try to kill you. Okay? And there have been people that have gone and, you know, we know someone who had a bomb placed in their house about 6-7 years ago on Purim because they were evangelizing. That person is a criminal.
But within the legal system, do you think that a Christian will get the same
the legal system, the legal system, and what is written in the law would protect that. Yes, the fact that people fall short is not what I'm talking about. The theory right now, you have to start with theory. You've got to get your theory right in order to have something to hold practice up against, so you can measure the practice. If you're talking about practice falling short, yes, practice falls short, but the theory is still is in place. What happens if the theory is wrong? What happens if in theory it says you have the right to kill that person according to the law?
The theory is in civil court, but not in a religious court. The theory may be there in the civil court, but it's not there in the religious court.
I don't know what's there in the religious court. I don't believe in the religious court a person is allowed to go and kill somebody that offends them.
No, but that's taking it to the extreme. The killing.
We're talking about an extreme here.
But I'm talking about other extremes. For example, taking people's children away from them. This is an extreme as well.
Yes, you know? that's an extreme, and hopefully the courts can rectify that. But imagine if you were in a system that was so extreme, mm-hmm. It's so extreme that 25 years ago, people didn't believe it, because I talked with people in the 80s, and they didn't believe that there was a system that was so crazy that you could actually demand the death penalty for them, for insulting Islam or for leaving Islam. That was just that's an unhuman idea. Well, for the last 25 years, it's been visible in the West that, in fact, what's always been going on in Saudi Arabia is now a glimpse of that is actually seen. Why is Saudi Arabia 100% Muslim? Because there are no other options. And the rest of the world has, you know, we don't accept slavery anymore. Slavery is not considered an option. Now, the practicalities, how do you remove slavery from earth? That's not been worked out yet. But in theory, it's not an option. In theory, it is evil to demand that a person cannot change their viewpoint. That somehow God's love for the world creates an openness. And God has created an open creation that allows people what looks to us like free choice. And stopping that is evil. And that's now been recorded in law with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That was 60 years ago, where this, you know, the idea that you can have totalitarian thought processes in place is evil.
Yeah, but don't you think that it's evil whether a person is penalized for this by the loss of their life, or say by the loss of their home? It's still evil.
Absolutely. Yes, I'm not. Hold it. Yes, it is still evil. I'm not denying it's evil. I'm simply going back to the most evil. The most evil is where you kill the person. A secondary level of evil would be where.
It's still evil.
Yes. It's a different degree where you take away a person's property based on these things. That's also evil. I'm not denying that. Yes, that's evil. What I'm saying is that our culture that we are developing in the West, we are not training our children in truth. We are not training our children to believe or to investigate or to search or to strive to find what is truth and to point out what is evil.
Our children are learning that it's much easier to go along because you might have to suffer. You might have to sacrifice if you say this is evil.
That is correct.
And you might live a better life. You might have a better standard of living if you just back out of the issue.
That is true. Now, there's someone... Yes?
Maybe the real challenge for Christians is how to love our enemies.
That is the challenge, and that's what we're coming. That was what I was trying to come back to. Thank you. Because if the Ayatollah is bearing the image of God, then we ultimately have to reserve a point of love for such a person. We are not allowed to shut ourselves up in bitterness. At the same time, we are allowed to fight and defend the evil that he is perpetrating. We can say that Stalin was evil. And at the same time that we say Stalin was evil, we can still say that as a child of God, we cannot be bitter. We cannot let...
You mean oppose the evil.
We can oppose the evil, absolutely.
You said defend the evil.
Defend against. We defend ourselves against the evil. To fill out that whole sentence. Thank you. We defend against evil. And having backbone, and having a backbone that's willing to stand up for something and to fight evil is also part of love. It's actually part of protecting the image of God. In order to love everyone, in order to protect the image of God, we have to stand up against evil. We have to train people that there is good, there is truth, and there is evil in the world, and that evil must be exposed, and it must be called evil, and when it attacks, it must be defended against. So there is a very high calling, and this whole issue of we love God, and because we love God, we don't have a right not to love our neighbor. 1 John 4 says brother, and so you can say, well, we certainly have no right to not love our fellow believer, fellow Christian, but we already know from Jesus' teaching that is not a limit. That is simply a training. Those are training wheels. We learn how to love our fellow believer so that we also learn how to love everyone. And with that, we balance it with training in recognizing evil and in calling evil evil. And religious totalitarianism, where you take away the right of choice from an individual, as soon as you've done that, you've actually taken away their image of God. You're no longer loving them as someone created in the image of God. You're turning them into a robot. And that is evil. And if you want to know where that can lead, well, it can lead to a lot of different places. It can lead to the Spanish Inquisition. It can lead to Saudi Arabia. It can lead to the Gulag. When you take away choice from someone who is created in the image of God, you are no longer loving that person. So that is part of this challenge. We need to train our children in the way to go. Oh, I wanted to quote something. There was a famous cartoon that... let me jump all the way back. 100 years ago, somebody was quoted, some military man was quoted, you know, "We have met the enemy and he is ours." And so he was expressing supreme confidence. And we had a political cartoonist in the 50s and 60s in the United States, and he wrote something that became etched in American folklore, and I think it's very much true for the kind of conundrum that we have here when we start thinking about what it means to love our neighbor. And that line, of course, is from Pogo. Many of you know it. "We have met the enemy, and he is us." And that's what op-ed was ultimately saying. You know, we've seen this fatwa against Salman Rushdie, but what we've really seen is the weakness in our own hearts retreating from calling that evil. There was some lip service, but there has been a retreating of being able to call that evil. And what that's really exposing is the inability. We don't really love God, and we don't really love our neighbor if we won't call evil evil. If we won't defend the truth, if we won't defend our children, if the children won't defend their parents, if we won't love God with all of our heart, with all of our strength, with all of our oomph, then that weakness, we need to repent, we need to fall before God and say, "Lord, mold us into your image so that we can truly love and that we can truly defend the widow and the homeless and the downtrodden and the weak, and set up a righteous system that protects the families and the property and the many layers that this ultimately works out to." It's a challenge of life. We've been in it for a few thousand years. We've been working on this for a few thousand years. We've made some progress. There have been horrible setbacks. And God's calling on all of us is to love God with all of our heart and to love our neighbor as ourself. So,
it's kind of a dual challenge, because it seems like the two tendencies are to either sort of slip into this kind of airy-fairy, lovey-dovey, fuzzy feeling about the world, and not be realistic about evil and sort of sweep that under the rug, or you retreat into this no, there is evil, and you let your heart harden and become full of hatred and fear towards the rest of the world. And you sort of have to avoid both those things.
You have to avoid both. It's a challenge. It's part of what makes the world go round. It's part of the challenge of that God has put in his family, in his people. So, yes. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much.